Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Indie Heads Podcast. I'm your host, Maddie, a.k.a. Recon IG, a.k.a. at Monrovian Prince on Twitter. On this week's podcast, we have...
Zach, I'm Waffle113 in both of those places Maddie just mentioned.
I'm Dylan. I'm
a motorcycle. American
Soviet on Reddit.com and at DecoJams on Twitter.com.
I'm Josiah. I am Wild Imp on Reddit and Joe_Sai_on Twitter.
So
phonetic spelling of my name.
Nice. We are all here for a very special occasion. Part one of our album of the year list. This is a very exciting time. We can finally end the listmas season correctly, as our list is the objectively correct list. Unlike
as always,
unlike Bitchfork and the needle drip, stereo gum stuck on
please
my shoe.
Please, stop, Tano.
Let's see, spin into another direction to a better music publication.
Are we still allowed to shit on Enemy for putting AM as our like album of the year from like 4 years ago?
All right,
good.
Fucking
AM was good.
Enemy, they are the true indie enemy. Anyways, let's get into the puns. This list.
Everyone knows the indie rock record of the year is the 1975's album.
Oh god. The best parts about that album are like the not indie parts, like the stuff where they're just making like straight up pop music. It's great, but when they try getting all like artsy and shit, it just no. Like stick to your guns, okay? You're good at making pop music.
No,
stick to your goddamn guns.
I actually haven't listened to it this year because I've kind of like refused to. Kind of the same way I didn't listen to like 21 Pilots.
I mean, there's a stigma. I mean, 21 Pilots, there's a deserved stigma. 1975, kinda not deserved.
The 1975
stigma?
Is a situation where I hate their fans more than the music. 21 Pilots, I hate the music and the fans, possibly the music more.
But like both bands have like a huge crossover. Anyway, this is getting off track.
Anyways, yeah. We're getting to our album of the year list. So we're gonna be going over our number 10 to number 7 pick. Why we're doing so little, you'll find out. And also, probably should explain how we do this list. So essentially, every member of the podcast, I think we missed a couple of members, but essentially everyone from the podcast puts in their own top 10. And going from number 1 to number 10, if you put an album at number 1, that's 10 points. Number 2, 9 points. Number 3, 8 points. Goes on down to number 10 to 1 point. And these points are all added up to our list. And so essentially, you can have a case where if two people rate an album really, really highly, like the album we're about to talk about, if two people rate it really highly, then it could somehow make our way onto our list. And I think that leads into our number 10 pick for album of the year. Dylan, I'll let you take this one. Because this one came to a surprise to me, and I'm happy it's on the list, but it was definitely surprising when we were like figuring out the list.
All right. At our number 10, this was should we explain that it's a tie, first of all? All right,
fine, it's a tie. So our number 10 pick is a tie between two albums. So the other day when we were deciding our awards and the album list, we thought we were done. Like, okay, so Angel Olsen, My Woman, that's our number 10. We're good. However, I was like, wait a second, let me check one more album. And I decided to check Sirens because I saw you had it at number 1. And so I do the Control F Sirens and I see that you have it at number 1 and Ali had it at number 8, which means it had 18 points and beat out Angel Olsen for the number 10 slot.
I literally stand Sirens so hard that it got on the list. Like, I fucking love it. All right.
But then Angel Olsen got on the list because I pulled the last minute cheat move. I pulled my trump card. I changed my list ever so slightly. I bumped Angel Olsen up to 3 instead of 4. So Frank Ocean got swapped between my list. And so therefore, it is a tie between Angel Olsen, My Woman, and Nicholas Jar Sirens. Well, let's talk about Sirens first. Dylan, to give you the spotlight real quick. Let's talk about this, as you wrote about it for a couple weeks ago for r/IndieHeads.
It was about 2 weeks ago. So Sirens, as you might have guessed already, Sirens is my album of the year. It's, I mean, I really can't talk enough about this album. I mean, it's a protest album. It's a progressive electronic album. It's an ambient album. It's a pop album. It has parts of like reggaeton and show tunes and like Brian Eno, you know, soundscapes, and it's just, it implements all of these styles just so wonderfully and seamlessly from track to track, and it's runs for like maybe like 40 minutes.
Hold on, Dylan, you just lagged there real quick. Can you just like whatever we said like 10 seconds ago, try to say that again real quick. Gotta love Skype.
He's frozen on my end.
Oh, have we lost Dylan?
He's able to like just what?
Okay, just go over again one more time, because I think you just froze for like 20 seconds.
Am I good?
You're good now. You're good now.
Okay.
Just start.
Right.
Start over.
Okay, let me just start from just how he's able to incorporate just all of these musical styles so well into what is just like a 6-track LP, and it's only like 40 minutes long too, and he's able to do this like absolutely flawlessly, at least in my opinion, going from just these very calm, collected soundscapes to, you know, very quick thumping techno beats, back over to just ambient progressive electronic, and then, you know, just back and forth, you know, he plays with these styles just back and forth, and I mean, it's wonderful. The album is based kind of in, I feel like I'm like repeating my write-up a little bit.
I mean,
but it really, you know, I mean,
you kind of like, have to with this stuff, because I know I'm gonna be repeating my write-up for one of these lists.
Yeah. I mean, the album is basically based pretty much around the Pinochet regime of the military dictatorship that ruled Chile for 18 years, and you know, the centerpiece of the album is the track "No," which is also based on the campaign in 80. I want to say it was like 93 or something like that, 89, 90, something like that.
It was like a few months after he was born when like Chile got their freedom back, which I think was like 90, it was like 92, 91, because he was 21 in 2011, so doing the math, yeah. So like 1990 essentially.
Yeah, yeah. And basically that track is just based around, it's like based one on the No campaign to oust Pinochet from power with the referendum. But it's also just based on this idea that, the dictatorship still has just massive influence over Chile and over Chilean society. And it's the pretty much the central focus of the album, and how it focuses on just the power struggle between, you know, older generations and the newer generation. The older generations, you know, kind of fucking everything up for the young people, but also the young people having to deal with a world now that, you know, pretty much a polluted world that they're trying to navigate. And really, the album feels very much, it's pretty much ready for the present day. I mean, we've had, you know, protest albums this year. We've had, you know, Lemonade. We had, you know, Pimp a Butterfly last year. But Sirens really feels like it's ready for like the next, kind of like the next stage of society, at least with, you know, Trump. And what basically seems like this sort of like global rise in you know, right wing
nationalism,
ultra nationalist, yeah. And so, really, while, you know, like albums like Lemonade and Pimp a Butterfly, they're angry and they're passionate. Jar takes them the much more artistic side of it all. He kind of shows this I don't quite know how to describe it, but
I guess a more nuanced take, maybe.
I didn't want to say intellectual because that sounds like really elitist.
Yeah.
But it's much more probably eclectic take, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, what I think is a very, very important album. It's my album of the year, and I know that for a lot of people, it's kind of a slow burn. Some of the initial reaction to it ranged from, hey, this is pretty good, to, I don't really quite get this. And, I kind of get that. I mean, Jar's music certainly isn't for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly for me, you know, as a fan of progressive electronic and just very unique music in general, it just spoke miles for me. And so that's pretty much all I have to say about it. I don't know if you want to like open it up to discussion now or
I'll talk about it a little bit because this is also it's not in my top 10, but I think it just barely made my top 20 this year. This is a great electronic mm-hmm. record, like through and through. I remember, so this is one of the mini albums that came out on September 30th, and it's probably, except for maybe one album, which technically didn't even come out on the 30th. We were like, you know, counting when it got released to streaming and whatnot. But of all the September 30th albums, this is definitely like my second favorite, you know, because I remember when Bon Iver came out that the same day and everyone was like, Bon Iver, Bon Iver, Bon Iver. And I listened to it. And I'm like, oh, this is okay. I'm going to listen to this Nicholas Jar album because Dylan's hyping it up. And it's like, wow, this is, I mean, it's definitely a slow burn, but it definitely grabbed me on first listen. It really did shake me to my very core, because the intro, Killing Time, it's this very like slow ambient piece, and you're kind of wondering, like, it's a risky intro too, because usually, you know, when you have albums, you want to start off kind of maybe bombastically, or you want to, you know, set the standard, like have a really nice set piece. And on this album, he kind of goes for a slower approach, and it's a long intro too. It's 11 minutes long, but for the most part, it's a very slow moving ambient piece. And it goes into The Governor, which is this very like fast paced, like, you know, has a techno beat, and it's great. And then, but I think my favorite cut on the album is Three Sides of Nazareth. That ended up being placing pretty high on my song of the year list. That's a fucking incredible track. You know, the sampled intro, which, because I guess that kind of sounds like a home movie of like Nicholas Jar and his dad.
It actually is a home movie.
Okay, that's why.
Yeah,
I thought.
It's like baby Nico and his dad. I think he's giving him like a piano lesson or something like that.
Talking about a statue and lions and shit. It's adorable, is what it is.
Yeah,
it's adorable, and it leads into this like really epic like protest song where you're talking about like just this really crazy imagery. And I think it's something that this album does so well, along with being like a very interesting protest album, especially like in our times. But also, it's very, you know, it strikes really strong imagery where you have lyrics like on Three Sides of Nazareth. I'm trying to find the lyrics real quick. You know, I found my broken bones by the side of the road. I found my broken home by the side of the road. I found my broken limbs by the side of the road. I found my broken friends by the side of the road. This sounds like a very apocalyptic album at times, and I think it's fucking great. It's definitely one of my favorites of the year, and I was happy to see it. I was happy to see it place on our list as I think it adds a little nice variety. As there wasn't really that much electronic stuff, because they're really like going through my top 50. There wasn't really that much electronic stuff that got me this year, but this album definitely did. So, Zach, do you have any thoughts on Nicholas Jar?
Like what you said about Killing Time, it would seem risky normally, but this is something that Nicholas Jar has done before. Like, he opened Dark Side with a song that's 15 minutes long, for crying out loud, and just like Killing Time, it was the best song on that record.
Yeah.
And, as for the record as a whole, I kind of talked about this when we did our September-October catch-up a few months ago,
mm-hmm.
but he's 3 for 3 for me. Like, Space Is Only Noise, great. Dark Side, even better. Sirens, not quite as great, but still really, really good. So that's kind of all I have to say about it.
And Josiah listened to it three or four times today, and he hasn't quite gotten it yet.
Yeah, I definitely can speak the least on it of anyone here.
Sorry to put the pressure on you.
I like the production, and I think that the overarching narrative is done very well. That's really all I can say on it.
Alright, yeah. So...
I want to give a quick shout-out, too, because, like, we mentioned literally every other track except the final one, History Lesson.
Yes!
Which is, like, it's basically, like, this, like, old 50s, like, show.
Yeah, it's, like, a repurposed, like, 50... Like, sounds like the electronic producer equivalent of a band at a 50s, like, prom night.
50s doo-wop. Like,
yeah.
Fucking... It sounds great. It goes through a lot of different types of sounds, but is able to incorporate them all really well. I think you articulated that really well, Dylan. Where it's just like there's so many different like genres that he goes for on this album, and he succeeds at like nearly everything, and it all fits together so well. It's just like it's absolutely insane how he's able to kind of mash these sounds together to like near perfection. So, very glad to have it number 10. But let's go to our other number 10 pick, Angel Olsen, My Woman. So this one ranks pretty highly on my own list. It ranks at number 3. And this is a fucking showstopper of a record where Angel Olsen kind of came at me by surprise this year as she dropped that earlier on the year. She dropped the intern like snippet video, and it was getting some buzz on indie heads. And I watched it, and I'm like, wow, what is this? This is... Like, this girl is powerful. She's such, like, the imagery in her lyrics and just, like, all this stuff was just like, holy shit, like, who is she? And then, you know, going through her back catalog a little bit after Shut Up, Kiss Me came out, which is, like, one of the best singles of the year and was one of our Song of the Year picks, or was one of our five nominees for that on the last episode. And after Shut Up, Kiss Me, I listened to Burn Your Fire for No Witness and then eventually Strange Cacti. And I'm just like, why am I just now listening to this girl? She's absolutely fucking incredible. She's just such a strong songwriter with such a unique sense of who she is and her place in the world. And I think My Woman just, again, ups that even more, where instead of the more kind of folk rock inspired tunes on her last album, she goes straight, like, head on into rock and roll, you know, 50s and 60s and occasionally 70s inspired stuff to just, again... great effect as again this record again it's been highly praised for a reason as Angel Olsen just again such an incredible songwriter, probably one of the best songwriters working today. And if we're looking at my own list, I guess this is my favorite singer songwriter record of the year, although it's kind of at times it's a little iffy to considering it a singer songwriter record, but it essentially is. But it's fucking incredible because you have side A and side B, which are perfectly split, where side A, you have these more direct and in punchy songs that really do lay on the 50s and 60s inspired, like, pop and country kind of really lays that influence on, but, you know, as their own sort of unique touch to it. And then side B, you have these more methodical, slower pieces that kind of lets the music build up a little bit, especially on the tracks Sister and Woman, where you have these songs that really build into these great crescendos that are just, you know, absolutely fucking incredible and really allow Angel Olsen to kind of shine as a lyricist and a songwriter and a band leader and all these different things where, again, this is just, again, from she just consistently keeps improving as an artist. And I'm really excited to see where she goes next after this album because, really, you know, there's a lot of directions she can go in. She can either go, you know, more into rock and roll, kind of maybe get more punky. Maybe she can, you know, go more in that synth pop direction that she was kind of hitting on Intern, as really that's the only track on the album that has those, pretty much the only song on the album that has any synths in it, as the rest of the album is pretty much a somewhat straightforward rock record, except for the last track, Pops, which is just this absolutely devastating piano ballad that I just absolutely just floors me every single time I listen. And I feel like I'm not being entirely clear. I'm just kind of going off in like random directions of how much I love this record. So does anyone else want to speak on My Woman really quickly?
I can speak a little on.
Come back to me.
Yeah, I'll do it. Yeah, this was a really interesting kind of shift for Angel Olsen, not just in like the sound and whatnot, but like you said, she really like came into her own even more, brought it up a level on this record, and just kind of like showed she obviously had confidence before, but really put that into front and center on her songwriting and made some really, really solid pop songs that I enjoyed. And the guitar is very kind of like 60s psych rock influence at times, which I like. Yeah, it's a really, just like you said, probably one of my favorite singer-songwriter records of the year.
Mm-hmm. And something I didn't really quite touch on a little bit is that it's not a, I feel like with the title and then some of the, I guess, the narrative behind the album in the press, mm-hmm. That it was kind of built to be this very, you know, feminist record. When in reality, it kind of is and it kind of isn't. It's very subtle in its more feminist themes, where
yeah.
It's, you know, essentially it is, Angel Olsen, she described it as her most, you know, autobiographical record yet. She really does go into some pretty personal aspects of her life. Not, like, super personal. Like, it's not like Sunkill Moon personal, where it's just like, dude, you're literally reading your diary, like, just in the studio for us. But really, again, really laying out who she is as a person and kind of opening herself up a little bit to her tales of heartbreak and just kind of, you know, learning, you know, kind of growing up, I guess. Not really growing up, because, again, she's pushing 30 soon. But, again, I think that the track Woman really does kind of, the lyrics on there where, you know, I dare you to understand what makes me a woman. I feel like none of us here have really any, you know, personal insight to what that means, I guess. But it is a very it's a powerful record, I think, very obviously. But and also you have, you know, like Shut Up Kiss Me, as I mentioned, where it's a, you know, a very direct song. It's not like, oh, I have a crush on this guy and I wish, it's like, no, it sounds like, hey, this is the end of the world and you're going to shut up and you're going to kiss me. I don't fucking care. You know, it's her kind of coming to terms of who she is as a person and really embracing, you know, some aspects of her personality that maybe she was afraid of doing before, which I think has had a direct influence in the sound being a much, you know, much more upfront and a lot less. It's not so sad and folksy. It's much more, it's direct, which I really, really enjoy from this record. It's just how direct it is at times. It's not being around the bush on certain aspects. It's like, this is what this record is. Deal with it. I love that.
More so than being like a feminist, like female empowerment record, I think this is more of a record about like expressing your emotions openly as a woman and just that, like the normalization of that, which is feminist, but not, I think, not in the typical way, which is interesting.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's definitely a really unique approach. Dylan and Zach, you guys have any thoughts?
Dylan, do you have anything?
I'll let you go first, Zach.
Okay.
Because,
So, like I said, when we discussed this album on its own podcast, one of the things that strikes me the most about this album, that it's practically unclassifiable, considering how many genres she dips her toes in.
Mm-hmm.
But the more I listen to it since, the more it strikes me as more this of my woman being a triumph of sheer ambition. It's like, look, I'm doing synth pop, I'm doing folk, I'm doing country, I'm doing rock, I'm doing all of these different things and doing them better than anyone you can probably think of right now.
Mm-hmm.
It is a triumph of ambition. She is showing that she can do all of this and make it sound just as good as anything she's done before. I'm really excited to see where she goes next, no matter what direction she takes, because as this record shows, she can go pretty much any direction and have it sound great.
I definitely agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
I guess because I know I wasn't on the My Woman podcast, so I'll have to, I guess, give him a quick rundown of it. I think in the end, you know, it's not like, kind of like Maddie said, it's not really an album about growing up, but it's definitely more about maturity and certainly I think this is her breakout album. I mean, I first heard about her back in 2014, I think it was, when she put out
Burn Your Fire
for No Witness, or whatever it was, something like that. Yeah. And, you know, that album took a really long time for me to warm up to, because it literally is a very slow, methodical burn. And, you know, it wasn't quite my favorite album of the year, but I definitely saw, you know, there's potential here for her to do something. And certainly with My Woman, I think she's starting to find it a little bit. Obviously, the first half of the album is probably my favorite, with You'll Never Be Mine, Shut Up, Kiss Me. And I think Matt is completely right when he says the second half is much more slowed down, slow paced, but much more introspective as well, a bit. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's not... I mean, this isn't my most favorite record of the year. It probably would be one of my favorite singer-songwriter records of the year, however. And I definitely think she's still got just a whole mess of potential to be one of the best songwriters, singer-songwriters, in the next few years. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think that's pretty much all I had to say on it. It didn't like quite make my like top 50 list. It is in my like honorable mentions, though, with like Savages and whatnot. I think, I don't know, this year was very good for female acts. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
I don't know if I really have much more to say. I guess going for Angel Olsen, definitely, like, again, still has so much potential of what comes next. If there's any slight gripes, which isn't really a gripe at the record, but more of a gripe for Angel Olsen going forward, I'd be interested to see it. Seeing how she modernizes her sound as time goes on, as, you know, she can't forever be making these kind of throwback sounding records. So for the next, I guess, couple albums, I'm interested to see, you know, what direction she goes in, as, you know, this isn't like the last, like, I still want to hear this type of sound from her. Like, I'd love to hear another record that's like, that goes in a direction of, you know, the second half, or goes in the direction of Intern with these kind of like old sounding synth pop stuff. But, yeah, I'm just trying to find extra stuff to say. But, yeah. Angel Olsen, number 10 on our list, tied with Nicholas Jaar with Sirens. So let's get into our number 9 pick for Album of the Year. James Blake, The Color in Anything, as we discussed earlier with the rules for this. If two people rate an album really highly, that is enough for it to probably get on our list, and that's exactly what happened here, as I had this as number 2 on my own list, and Stefan had it as number 1 on his list, which just barely gave it the bump up to number 9. And so I'll discuss this.
Literally, but like 1 point.
1 point. By 1 point, yeah. Has beaten Nicholas Jaar and Angel Olsen. I've talked about this, you know, this album extensively on the podcast before, but give it a little rundown again. James Blake is essentially kind of my gateway artist for getting into indie. He was one of my, you know, couple of gateway artists for getting more into indie music, I think. James Blake, Death Grips are like two of the main ones for me, and which is why I hold them so like dear to my heart, because it's like, without them, I would not be into the music that I'm in today. Like, I'd still be listening to fucking Odd Future, or like, I don't know. I probably would think Views is a good album if I was still like if I never got into Death Grips or James Blake.
There's like a photo on your Instagram of you basically looking like a thumb at like a Mac Miller concert.
Oh my god! I feel like Jesus Christ, dude! Don't even fucking mention that. Jesus,
so basically, Christ. James Blake like saved you from that.
It did save me.
Butterfly effect.
Oh my god. Anyways, this record here is absolutely incredible. It's his first record in about 3 years since Overgrown, and this record. At first, the feedback was really positive when this came out. Like, people were like, "Wow, this is fucking great! It's totally worth its length." But as the year went on, much more people were starting to forget about it. And, you know, whenever it was brought up, they're like, "Eh, it wasn't really that good, or it was kind of underwhelming." There's some great stuff on here, but it's like, and I'm like, "What are you talking about?" It's like this entire album, except for maybe like one or two songs, is like all great and really definitely pushes his sound forward, where it really combines some of the best aspects of Overgrown and James Blake while also going into a newer, newer direction, which I think the big one of this album is that it's a much more collaborative effort, where before on Overgrown and in James Blake, the self-titled, those are very, sort of lonely albums. They're very much of James Blake of his own accord for him. While on the other hand, The Color Anything, there's much more different sounds in here. You definitely hear some influences from some of the people who helped make the album. Like, you hear more Bon Iver influence at times. You hear some Frank influence at times, especially on the track My Willing Heart, which he co-wrote. Which, there's some lyrics in there that's like, oh, of course Frank wrote that. Like, that's a total Frank lyric. And also Rick Rubin contributed a lot to the production of this record. And, but also, again, it doesn't let up on the usual James Blake-ness of his previous records. It's still very much a James Blake album, but there is still, influence there from much more influence than usual. Where I think, just starting off with the intro track, Radio Silence, I think on my Spotify, it was my most listened to song of 2016. So I think that tells you a lot about my 2016, all right? It wasn't good. Wasn't good for the most part. A lot of bad. All right, so I came back to this track a lot, as it samples this Bill Withers track, which Stereogum's Tom Breehan talked about in his review, which I think he said a lot of great stuff about, sort of comparing the two between this version and then James Blake interpolation of that song, where, right away from the beginning, James Blake sounds absolutely devastated. He's in shock, that his significant other just, again, the song, it's essentially written in the perspective of someone who just got broken up with, like, just the instant moment that they realize this is over. Like, whatever we had, it's officially, like, done. And he's able to create this atmosphere of, like, where if he feels something, he's going to make sure that you feel that too. And he does that so well on this track, where there's these really, like, painful lyrics and, this really cold and moody beat with these, sort of minimalistic, not minimalistic, but sort of, more in the background percussion and some icy, the vocals are very, like, ethereal and ghostly, and it's just like, ugh. And there's so many, like, moments on this record that just make me go, oh, that's so good. Like, how does he do it? I think a track I was listening to before the podcast, I Hope My Life, I kind of get why people hate on the beat, because that synth is very blaring and annoying. But Dylan, I think you and I know, those are true plebs. They cannot enjoy that synth, because that's a fucking great synth. That just, true. Like, it, true. You just like, every single time that comes on the album, I'm just like,
I mean, like, immediately from just, like, the start of, like, you know what's gonna happen, you're just like, oh, shit, and then it just progresses into this just monster of a track, and you're like, I'm not okay with any of what's happening right now.
It's just, again, it's
emotionally,
like,
of course.
It's like an alarm going off. It's like this sense of urgency in this song, where, it's James Blake kind of coming to terms with some of his, the fact that he's alive. Like, oh shit, like, coming to terms with his morality. I hope my life. Shit, hold on. Why am I drawing a blank on the lyrics? I hope my life. I hope I'm right when I'm speaking my mind. Like, oh god, just there's so much great stuff. And then you have the second half, which I think Stefan, if you didn't read my write up on the album, Stefan, aka Apotheosis 91,
Stefan, we wish you were here.
We wish you were here, man. He would have loved this list. Because this list is essentially like at least like three albums on this list are like in his top five, I think. But anyways, you kind of mentioned that essentially the album is kind of a, like the Angel Olsen record, where Angel Olsen record, it's very, the side A and side B are very like split down the middle of like, hey, this is like this, this is like that. where on this album it's much more subtle, where, you know, My Willing Heart being kind of the centerpiece of this sort of emotional change, where on the first half of the album you see James Blake kind of wallowing in his depression. He's fucking sad, all right? He's really fucking sad. He's really wallowing in his breakup and just like wanting to be accepted by someone, where kind of after My Willing Heart, you know, I guess in some ways it's a boost. It's a personality boost for him, where he becomes much more confident in himself and, you know, kind of realizing what he's no longer wallowing. He's trying to actively get out, you know, from the depression, where there's a couple cases where he kind of dips back in a little bit, like I Need a Forest Fire. He kind of dips back in a little bit into that, where it's like, I need, you know, like I need to get out of this. Or you have Two Men Down, which is just, oh, such an incredible fucking track. Jesus Christ.
Can we talk about Noise Above Our Heads real quick? Because
that's
honestly always... that's my favorite track on the record.
That's my least favorite track.
Are you kidding me?
It is my least favorite track. If there's like people have talked about, there's maybe some filler tracks on this album. I think for the most part there's no filler, but if there's any song in here that comes close to sounding like filler, it's Noise Above Our Heads. I'm so sorry, Dylan, but I'll let you talk about why you like the track. I'll let you go.
I mean, first of all, it's just a wonderful beat, first of all, and just, I just really love how James Blake basically just lets himself loose on it eventually. I mean, the lyrics are pretty kind of not quite sad boy Blakey, kind of. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, he's just like, you know, I'm, you know, I'm here when you don't sleep so well, and it's just like, oh shit, James is trying to, like, play a little bit of, like, a fuck you role, almost.
He's trying to mack on a fly honey.
Basically. as James Blake has ought to do, obviously. Honestly, I just love it. It kind of like encapsulates everything that I love about Blake, especially like everything that I loved about Overgrown, and just the electronic instrumentation that he also showed off in his self-titled debut. I love that. And some of the other like slower chops on this album, I think one of them is like Waves No Shores is another one of them, where it's a very slow, syrupy ballad, basically. Very much sounds like something that was written in like the Overgrown era, almost. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just fantastic.
It's still a good song. I think like he hits a really great high note on the song too, which is like fucking great. One of my favorite moments on the record. But yeah, this thing again, it's 17 tracks, and it does not let up for any of them. Like every track has its place on this record, which is something that I disagree with a lot of people who say this record is too long. It's just like every track here, like, has its place. There is a reason that this track is here. Like it fits. It all like. I wouldn't get rid of a single like song on this album. Like even Noise Above Our Heads, I would not get rid of it on this album. It's necessary for the story that James is trying to tell, essentially.
Yeah. You know? Well, like for me, it kind of makes it kind of creates this very interesting contradiction where, like, okay, first of all, it's 17 tracks long, and it's like it's almost like almost 80 minutes long. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of ridiculous, but like every track also deserves to be on here, so it's kind of impossible to almost cut anything from it.
Yeah.
So personally, you know, it actually does leave a lot of room to just kind of just skipping through it and being like, hey, I want to listen to this. Okay, no, skip that. You know, it's kind of it presents itself in a way that it allows the listener to pretty much dive into it with whatever mood they want.
Yeah, there's definitely those are things. Also, there's some really great another like criticism that people have about this album that I completely disagree with. It's like, oh, it has too many piano ballads, and I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? It does have a lot of piano ballads, but like they're all great. Like fucking Forever, fuck my shit up, man. Like that's a fucking great track where It's probably my favorite of the piano ballads on the album, where it starts off kind of happy, you know, like, don't use the word forever. It's like, all right, so this is going to be kind of, you know.
I forgot about that part on Forever. I was like, if there's one track I don't like, it's Forever. Then I remembered that. I'm like, nope, never mind.
Because it starts off like, oh, kind of like a little cheerful, and then, you know, those dark chords start coming in where it goes, you know.
Yeah, opposite. Yeah.
And it's just like, oh, no. No, and you're just so sad by the end of it. You're like, "Fuck, man, oh." See, I think about the song sometimes, like Jeremiah and AJ talk about Psychopop, where it's just like, I can't use words sometimes. I just have to use just like, I just open my mouth and whatever noises come out. That's just, hey, that's how I feel, man. Can't hate on me.
Well, I mean, my history with this album has been one of, I mean, when it first dropped, I immediately loved it, and I thought this is one of the best albums I've heard all year. And it came out in like, what was it, like April or something?
It was like early May, I think.
Yeah, something like that. And I thought, and it was one of the best albums I had heard all year. And then I kind of, you know, a few months afterwards, I kind of fell out of it, and I didn't really listen to it at all. And then, once, you know, like, the end of the semester started coming up back in, I want to say, like, early November or something like that, I started listening to it more and more, and I pretty much fell back in love with it. And my history with James Blake is that I'm a huge Overgrown fan, and I'm not as into his debut, which his debut feels almost like a soulless R&B record, basically, which is very cold, very electronic, very robotic, almost, except for with a few obvious exceptions.
See, I don't disagree with you on that, but I don't know if that's a bad thing. I think that's the sound he was kind of going for, but I think that but I am Overgrown fam. I think that's his, well, I think honestly this album is his best album yet, but Overgrown at the time was my favorite album from him.
Yeah,
it was continued.
I mean, Overgrown is finally just kind of like him finding the soul and the humanity that was missing from his debut. And this album kind of feels like Color and Anything kind of feels like almost like a victory lap, basically kind of meshing the two kind of styles, where some tracks he's very open and very, you know, heart-wrenching, and others he's very cold and distant. But, you know, some people were complaining about like a lack of kind of progression almost in Blake, just as, you know, sonically. But I really think it's just him kind of honing his craft and doing what he does best on this album, which is just making very, very slow, sad, fuck me up music.
Pretty much.
Can I speak on this?
Yep, just go ahead.
Alright. I actually have an analogy to make here, and I'm gonna preface this by saying that I'm more of a self-titled man than an Overgrown man, but even though I liked this album overall, I'm gonna be the negative Nelly in this discussion, so bear with me here.
Oh, just you wait, Josiah. I have thoughts too.
All right, so if there's any like artistic endeavor that I would have to compare the Color and Anything to, it would be season 2 of Twin Peaks. Both very long and both kind of trying very hard to live up to their predecessor. And I obviously you guys disagree, but I feel that it's just a tiny bit too long. And I don't think that it's because there's any bad songs on this album. I think that too much of a good thing can sometimes be bad, is what I'm trying to say. But similarly to season 2 of Twin Peaks, I, in my opinion, this album kind of loses its footing a little, like after My Willing Heart. There's like a two or like three song, or I guess like four song thing, where like I don't think any of these songs are bad necessarily. I think that, like, if you could have cut one or two of them, it would have really, like, trimmed it down and made it just like the perfect length, in my personal opinion. And then it picks up again around Two Men Down in the same way that Twin Peaks Season 2 picked up near the end. But yeah, that's kind of what I have to say there.
I never watched Twin Peaks, but I do see your analogy, and you're totally justified. I do think that people say that it's too long. I get it, because it is 76 minutes long. It is 17 tracks. I can tell I get the too much of a good thing.
Yeah, I don't blame anybody for saying if they think it's too long, because it's pretty much. I think it's longer than both Overgrown and Self-Titled like combined, mm-hmm. almost.
Jesus Christ!
I don't know. Check my math on that.
Let's see, hold on. I'll check.
Zach had something to say, though, I think.
While I check the math, Zach, what were you going to say about this album?
Okay, I feel kind of bad doing this, because this podcast is meant to be a time of celebration, our favorite albums of the year and all that, and you and Dylan were just gushing over it. It was very hard for me to see, but I fall a bit more on Josiah's side here than I fall on you guys' side, and maybe it's because I never overgrown, so I might be missing the middle piece here, but My thoughts are basically Josiah's. Like, I think that all the tracks should be there. I think they all serve a purpose, but only 5 of them are less than 4 minutes. I definitely think some of them could be trimmed down a bit. And this is not to say I hate the record. Like, Radio Silence is easily one of the best songs of the year, probably my favorite opener of the year. But the thing with this record for me is it's very much a mood record. If you're in the mood that James is trying to create over the course of the record, then it's fantastic. I had days where I listened to that record and I thought, holy shit, this is absolutely amazing. But I also had days where I didn't feel like what the record what the record felt like to me. And it was the longest 76 minutes in the world to get through. It has highlights and it's still a very strong record, but I'm just not as high on it as you guys. Sorry about that.
That's okay. Again, here's the thing. I do get some of the criticism, again, that it's too long, too much of a good thing. Like, I get that. But, you know, I'm just a mega James Blake stan, so it's like, hey, I'll take this. I mean, there's cases where, that's not always the case for certain artists, where it's too much of a good thing, or it's just sort of, like, a combination of like, everything they've done prior to this. Like, the new Death Grips record. I like Bottomless Pit. I can't go as far to say that I love it, though, even though, again, I fucking love Death Grips and my favorite band of all time. But yeah, there is a case where it's just stuff. But I do think what this record does, The Color Anything, compared to maybe Bottomless Pit, where Bottomless Pit feels like it doesn't have a direction, it doesn't have a complete identity, I think The Color Anything has an identity. It has a reason. It's like, hey, this is what this record is. Like, it has a purpose. You know, it's not just like, you know, this isn't the record that we're just kind of having fun. It's like, no, this is a very necessary piece of art that James Blake had to get out there. Otherwise, you know, he would have, you know, fucking imploded, you know? Because there is, you know, if you're reading into the backstory, he definitely had his struggles making this album, where he had multiple fits of writer's block, where...
Wasn't he smoking too much weed?
Oh, yeah, that's what inspired one of the best tracks in this album, Put That Away and Talk to Me. Where he was just smoking... He was smoking just way too much weed, and it was just affecting his music in the worst way possible, or it was just making it just so, like, dull that he realized, oh, fuck, I gotta quit this. Stop smoking weed, moved out to L.A., finished the album at Rick Rubin's studio, and it's great. But yeah,
that definitely. Interview he did with Pitchfork was great. Like, he talked about getting lost on the way to meet Kanye West. It was so fun.
I'm kind of happy that feature didn't happen, honestly. Like, I don't think it would have fit on the record. No, it would have been. It would have, like, even the Vince Staples, the timeless Vince Staples remix that came out. That's like, glad that's not on the record, because that would not have fit like at all. But I mean, maybe James Blake could have made it. I think actually it could have worked, because, like, here's the thing: James Blake somehow made a RZA feature work on Overgrown. That's fucking RZA. He somehow made that shit work. So he could definitely make Kanye work. Vince Staples, no, it wouldn't have worked. But anyways,
I mean, it could work. Like, the EP, the Prima Donna EP shows that they can work well together.
Yes, but the timeless version that they put out, like, that would not have. Yeah. If that was in the album, I would have been like,
I think there's like a live version of Vince's. Of what would have been his verse on Timeless.
No, it's out. There's a studio version.
Yeah. Oh, is there?
There is, yeah.
Oh. I've only heard the live version then.
All right. Well, then. Yeah. It's
never mind.
All right.
Ignore
anyways,
me.
Anyways,
two more things.
Okay. Geez.
Okay. First, Maddie, quick yes or no question. If I listen to Overgrown, will I appreciate the color in anything more?
Yes or no? Yes, I do think you will, because I think this is an extension of Overgrown, where James Blake was much more focused on the production. I think Overgrown was him kind of stepping up a bit as a singer and songwriter. And I think the coloring thing kind of combines all that together, where you have some of his best production yet, where he really is, you know, doing some very, you know, genre pushing, you know, kind of his own self innovation for himself in the production front, but also still, you know, making his lyrics and his singing and his songwriting are still like they're steadily becoming stronger. And as Dylan was talking about, it's pretty much just like him like improving on his craft. And like for that, it's like I'm glad. Like, thank you for this. Like, that's what I want. Like, it's perfect. So...
Okay, and number two.
Yeah.
I would like to formally apologize for comparing this record in a disparaging manner to Starboy a few months ago when I was listening to Starboy. I was not in the right state of... I was just very angry. Guys.
All right. I accept your apology, Zach. I accept your apology.
Also, really quickly, I did the math, and yes... Color in Anything is exactly as long as his other two albums.
Whoa!
So, yeah.
Jesus Christ. Yeah. All right.
I wonder if that was purposeful.
All right, so I think that wraps things up pretty well. Color in Anything is our number 9 pick for our favorite podcast, IndieHeads podcast album of the year list. And also Me in the Maze. It's a great outro. It's very slow and brooding, but it's fucking perfect because music can't be everything. Just had to put that in there. All right, Zach. This one's all yours. Our number 8 pick for
I'm not emotionally ready for this one. Next one.
Our number eight pick for album of the year: Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, Skeleton Tree. Zach, I'll let you take this one on.
Oh my God, you're gonna be amazed by how little I have to say for my favorite record of the year. But here goes nothing. I'll put it like this. It is the most amazing, brilliant record that I am never in the mood to listen to. It is just, it's oppressive in how sad it is. And given the circumstances surrounding the record, which I won't repeat, we should all know them by heart by now. It makes sense. That's probably exactly what Nick Cave wanted from this record. He needed to get this out of his system, much like you said, James Blake needed to get Color in Anything out of his system, because if he didn't, I don't know what would have happened. But to talk about the actual record, like I said, it's my album of the year. I love it wholeheartedly. Cave's lyrics are just so evocative and piercing. It's like I said, really difficult for me to put into words. Dylan, help!
Okay, oh gosh, this album speaks for itself, really, how fucking, I don't know, I mean, I've literally listened to it three times, and,
twice.
Yeah, that's the thing, and I seriously don't know how else to talk about this other than this is literally, like it's kind of like the Santan Tango of albums, pretty much. I mean, that's the closest I can get to, and it's even not that accurate.
God, I can say anything about it. It's about a pain that I hope none of us experience.
Well, okay, the other thing, too, is that he wrote, like, the vast majority of this album even before the whole incident occurred. So it's like, Jesus Christ, he came up with this and then just worked, I assume he just worked the rest of the orchestration of the album around that incident.
Yeah, like, Nick
which
Cave,
is just, it,
that song's when he's in a good mood.
Yeah, I mean, Jesus Christ. I mean, I discovered Nick Cave, you know, just a few years ago with Push the Sky Away, and since then I've worked back through his discography with, you know, Murder Ballads and Let Love In, Dig Lazarus Dig, Boatman's Call, and just, I mean, the first time I heard Boatman's Call, I was like, holy shit, this is some really heavy stuff. And like the, like when I first heard Jesus Alone, which is like the lead single off of it, I was like, yep, this is gonna be,
yep,
just emotionally just heartbreaking. And it was
steroids.
Oh yeah, no, not that's, even that. It's like,
talk about this record, but that's kind of what it is.
It's like Boatman's Call, but it has like a terminal disease, and also all of its loved ones have like passed away, and also like the sky has blacked out and it's the apocalypse, basically. I mean, like, just let me hold on, let me track listing this now, because it's literally, it's like 10 tracks long, but it's basically
eight. Not even that.
Yeah. Oh yeah, no, it's like 8. It's ridiculously short, and you know, it's almost minimalistic, basically. It is minimalistic on pretty much every level, even from, yeah, you know, just from the cover to the orchestration to the track listing, and
it's
even
kind of
the
like natural successor to Push the Sky Away in that regard.
Yeah, yeah, even like the name Skeleton Tree, it like implies something that's very stripped away and very just bare all, literally. I mean, Jesus Alone opens the album, and it's basically a drone song, pretty much. And it's like, Jesus Christ. And then it goes into Rings of Saturn, which, I mean, it's just beautiful. It really is beautiful. I really love the backing chorus. I think it's on Rings of Saturn.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. It's on It's either on Rings of Saturn or Girl in Amber. I don't remember which one it is.
And that's like the only sunshine you get until the last song. After that, it's just sadness, misery, straight on through.
Oh yeah. I mean, Girl in Amber, I don't even want to talk about Girl in Amber. I mean, Jesus Christ. Anthrocene, Jesus. I feel like we're just talking in circles now, and it's just like, oh, this song, that's a sad one. Oh, that's Girl in Amber, that's a sad one. But really,
it's really,
I mean,
doing the record a disservice, but how else can we talk about it?
Yeah. I'll get what little I have to say about it out of the way, because I've spent like the least amount of time with it and the least amount of time with Nick Cave. But in my time with it,
hello,
it reminded me.
I'm here still. I spent less time with this record than you have. No, continue though.
No, literally, I've had one listen of this, and that's the entirety of my Nick Cave like listening, literally. But in that one listen, I was actually reminded thematically kind of a Black Star, not just in like the similarities in the instrumentation, but that I think that can't be separated from their context, like it's just impossible. And but both are just amazing records in spite of that, and the instrumentation is extremely beautiful on this. It's just like, it makes me want to listen to more of Nick Cave, which obviously I know is a crime that I've done literally none of prior to this, but yes, I enjoyed it very much.
I mean, like, it really does feel like we're talking in circles about just how sad all these tracks are, but like it's done so in a very tasteful way, basically. I mean, just everything here is just soul crushing, but it's really because it's very heartfelt. It's very meaningful.
It's not at all sad for the purpose of being sad.
Yeah.
Oh no.
Basically.
No.
Those last three
tracks are the most direct, heart-wrenching songs I have heard this entire year. I can't get through I Need You. I physically
can't. Yeah, I can't do it either. I really can't do it either. I mean, you want to talk.
Shame because I Need You is a wonderful song, but it's just so happy and emotionally direct. I can't. He sounds like he's about to cry in studio.
Here's the thing. He does Need You, and then you think, okay, please, you know, give me a break. And then he goes, like, directly into Distant Sky. And you think you're already, like, a puddle at, like, that point? And then Distant Sky happens? I sat there for a good, maybe, like, 10 minutes after Distant Sky, and I was just, like, I didn't know what to do. Honestly, I mean, it's so. I forget who does the backing vocals on
Elsa Torp, I think. I think that's it.
Yeah. And it's just. It's so fucking beautiful.
Isn't it?
Oh my god. But then, you know, he ends it on. And I think you mentioned this, Zach,
like,
in your write-up.
Not really optimism, so to say, but.
But just as a way to, like. Yeah, basically.
It happened. I need to try to move on.
Yeah.
It's all right now.
Yeah.
Maddie, do you have anything?
I literally, like, I listened to Sound of the Day while I was playing Skate 3. Very appropriate thing to play. I paused it about halfway through to watch Mega 64 Christmas Cast 2013 because it was harshing my mellow trying to play Skate 3. So, I don't have much to say. I will probably listen to this a bit more because I know you guys love it so much, and it's like it's definitely like an album that's like, at first I'm like, okay, there's some interesting stuff going on, but I definitely should probably listen to it like 5 more times to figure out what the fuck is going on in like half of this. But
that's worse than me listening to Sirens while playing GTA 5 online.
Yep. Well, I don't know. That's what happens. Sorry, guys.
It happened.
I mean, just also quick shout out to my dad because he basically listens to this album like several times a week. Like he's pretty much listened to it like every single day I've been home during this winter break, and I'm just like, Dad, how?
Does he just think Radiohead is some pussy shit? Like.
He actually only likes the Bends. That's like the only Radiohead album he likes.
That is one of the most fuck me up Radiohead albums, so it makes sense.
Yeah. So I think we've sad boyed over this one enough. God, we've gone through some really depressing albums, I realize. We've gone through Sirens, we've gone through Color in Anything, we've gone through Skeleton Tree.
We're about to get even more depressing. Well, kind of.
Oh, no.
With our number 7 pick. Danny Brown.
Hold on.
What? Hold up.
Okay, we got it. Go. All
right. Danny Brown, Atrocity Exhibition, is our number 7 pick for Album of the Year.
Woo! I wouldn't even call this depressing. It has depressing, like... Okay, you bitch. It has depressing subject matter, but it covers it in such an interesting way that I wouldn't actually call the tone of it depressing.
Okay, here's the thing. It's a secretly... it's kind of obviously fuck me up, but it's like a different brand of fuck me
up.
It's
like a Danny Brown fuck me up.
Exactly.
Which is like not... Which is completely different from like the rest of it, but it's still... It's like an... Thematically, it's a very dark album.
Yeah,
like it's not exactly 30 levels of fuck me up from Danny because he can get really, really fuck me up if he wants to, but it's still very dark, downcast, and the projection reflects this like fucking downward spiral. Sounds like he's rapping over the bass from the Breaking Bad theme.
It's like people have said that he's inventing a new genre with this record, and I don't like completely agree with that because he's been doing this fuck me up shit like since XXX and even a little bit before that, but like the difference is now he's fully like melded it with the almost post-punk aesthetic and even some other different influences, and I think in that regard it's production wise definitely I would say his best album, and it's certainly his most ambitious project yet.
To Warp is best thing that's ever happened to him. Like, they spent like what, $45,000.
Actually, Zach,
and it was worth every penny. This record sounds.
Actually, add 30,000 more. I think it was like 70,000 to 75K on like how much the samples cost for this
Jesus.
Record. And it does not go to waste. Production wise, this is the best hip hop album that I've heard in years in terms of instrumentals. Mm-hmm. You will not hear another hip hop album. I mean, even with Death Grips, you will not hear a hip hop album with some of the sounds that Danny has on this album. Where there's just times in this album when you are listening to him. Actually, we should probably explain the backstory, but let me explain, I guess, the backstory. So obviously, Danny Brown, broke out back in 2011 with XXX. 2013 dropped the follow-up Old, and now 3 years later has dropped Atrocity Exhibition, which is sort of kind of closing a trilogy in his life a little bit with this album, where XXX was very much about the party lifestyle and kind of, you know, briefly touched on the darker aspects of it, but really it was mostly about Danny Brown kind of it was still him coming towards his past. I mean, every record is him looking at his past a little bit. But XXX was sort of him kind of dipping into the darker aspects of the drug lifestyle, and Old was kind of more embracing the certain aspects of the drug lifestyle, at least on the second half. But this record, almost the entirety of it is, I am going full-on headfirst into the dark, really, truly dark aspects of drug addiction and just mental health. And and with the sounds he pulls out in this album, you really do, like, it's an album that you, not only do you, you know, you listen to it, you feel what he's feeling. Like, when he's talking about being fucked up, the sounds that are on this album, you feel that too. You feel like you're fucked up too. Like, especially on some cuts in here, you know, like, I think the biggest one, which we might as well just get out of the way, Ain't It Funny? Jesus Christ.
Holy shit.
So when this came out, I was kind of like, you guys that are, I think Dylan, you and AJ and a couple other people had already listened to the album, or at least you guys were already pretty into the album. And yep. I was like kind of late on it. And you said, just wait till Ain't It Funny. Like, that is like, holy shit, dude. And I'm like, okay, all right, this is great. So the at first it's like, okay, this is pretty good. Definitely going to, you know, take a couple listens to really grow on me. But once Ain't It Funny came in, I'm like, oh god, what am I in for? I'm in for some shit, man. If there's any song this year that I want to listen to again for the first time, it's Ain't It Funny. Because it is absolutely bonkers. It's fucking insane. It just, like, how does he rap over it? There's like, so many times
that track. That track is a monster in the literal sense of the word. Like, what did they do to those horns? Why does the percussion sound like elephants marching by? How is he rapping over this?
It literally sounds like Danny, it literally sounds like he listened to the Talking Heads and was like, I'm going to rap over that.
Yeah.
Except I'm just going to, like, make it fucked way more fucked up than any Talking Heads song.
Oh, yeah.
Jesus. I mean, just, again, those blaring horns. The fucking, just, like, they're so loud and distorted. And you have that kick. That again, it's a simple kick drum beat. But yet, it still feels so urgent. And then Danny Brown comes in with this just fast-paced flow, just very, like, short lines, like, holy shit, like, what is happening? And it's just like, like, you are completely frightened. And then it doesn't just end there, where it kind of fades out. But then it goes right into Goldust, which is just, like, also, like, absolutely insane, and just has you so confused of, like, what the fuck did this album do? The album before this point, before Ain't It Funny, was already really fucking insane. But, like, he takes you on, like, but still, somehow, despite the fact that it already starts out so insane, he pulls a complete, like, detour on you and just goes just even further down the rabbit hole. You thought you were at the bottom of the rabbit hole. Oh, guess what? Nope. The earth just fell through. There's more rabbit hole to go through. Just like, wow. And then Goldust and then White Lines was just like, Danny Brown sounding just absolutely fucking, like, insane, where he's talking about doing coke and shit, and you're just, you feel like you're high on cocaine listening to this part of the album, and it's just like...
I was about to say, it's appropriate.
It's kind of psychotic in a way, basically.
It is.
It's appropriate because the beat on White Lines gives me a headache when I listen to it. It's almost painful for me to listen to at times, but all is forgiven when it cuts into Pneumonia and... Like, those fucking bells hit you like a kick to the chest. It's, like, the best transition I've heard all year.
Can we talk really quickly about just the features on Really Dough?
Because
I mean, it's incredibly low. I mean, first we have Kendrick on the hook, which is just holy shit. Then you have, I think it's Absol as well.
Yeah.
In like the middle, and he actually does a pretty good job on
it. Why didn't Absol do this on his new record? His new record is trash.
I'm going to go as far as to say I liked Absol's feature on this more than Kendrick's feature. I liked the hook more than Kendrick's feature.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah, I agree. But like, it's not even the best feature on the track, in my opinion, because then Earl
dominates that song.
He just steamrolls everybody with it. I mean, Jesus Christ. And it kind of like cements in my mind that okay, Earl is going down, just a very creatively dark, very just fuck me up direction artistically.
If you didn't already know that,
I mean, like everybody I think it just kind of progresses. Like he puts it on like just this entirely new level of it. I think. Like, I mean, beyond Doris and I Don't Like Shit. I mean, it's just holy fuck. Go ahead. I'm cutting over you too much.
And even I was blown away with how Earl just, like you said, he steamrolled everybody. This is his song. There is no disputing that. It may say Danny Brown, an artist, but that's Earl Sweatshirt's song. Make no mistake.
Oh, God.
Basically.
Danny definitely, I'm not Danny, Earl definitely kills it on that feature. I was one of the people who, I wasn't a big fan of I Don't Like Shit. I wasn't the biggest fan of it. I think the single he put out after, Solace, is the best thing he's ever done. Like, Jesus Christ. And I would be interested to see if he goes more into, I guess, more fucked up territory. But yeah, everyone in Really Dough kills it.
Yeah, he put out a Adult Swim single this year. I think it's about like his grandmother or something again. And
that who he did it with?
I have no clue.
He did a song with Alchemist, or it was either Alchemist or Sam I Am or something like that.
He did a song with Sam I Am that was supposed to be on I Don't Like Shit, and I'm actually of the opinion that if you put that in the track list where it's supposed to be, I Don't Like Shit is like the second best rap album of 2015.
Mm-hmm. Anyways, we're talking about Danny Brown. Let's get back to Danny. I think we mentioned with the intro track that again, it's essentially like Danny rapping over a post-punk like instrumental, you know, where it definitely like it sets the tone of the record really well. And like, hey, you are in for some shit, okay? You know, it's the downward spiral, which he's mentioned before on XXX, but really it's him kind of...
Real again, interesting parallels there.
Really, it's him detailing the downward spiral, really, which I think is the main thing that Zum does, that sonically and lyrically, he really does get into the nitty-gritty of this is what drug addiction is like. You know, this is what happens to your mental health because of drug addiction, or really just, this is my mental health, and this is what drug addiction has, you know, attributed to that.
Yeah. You can't get it up because you're addicted to drugs.
XXX is like it's a album about that, but disguised as an album full of bangers. And this like just puts it front and center. And he doesn't hide it. He just tells you exactly how it is. Like, tell me what I don't know about like them getting put on probation and just like how the system is fucked up, and it is, but it's just like, tell me what I don't know. It's very straightforward.
I mean, old is kind of like over the top and overblown, but at some parts it just I don't know, it doesn't really sell itself very well. And just everything, but like everything on Atrocity Exhibition is just turned up just way beyond anything on old, but the thing is that it actually does sell itself. You know, it's able to stand on its own pretty much for pretty much every track other than probably Get High. I mean, beyond that, I mean, I love literally every single track on this record.
Mm-hmm. I know we talked about when we did our kind of mini discussion on this album not too long ago, where really the album up until really Get High and Hell For is like super strong. Like it's consistently like great. But I think since that podcast, the last two tracks, especially Hell For It, have definitely grown on me for what they are. I think Get High, again, it's a nice like come down song of like after the complete almost insanity for most of the album. It's a nice kind of a come down. It kind of him. Narratively, it's him kind of forgetting about that. He's not fucked up, you know. Well, he is fucked up, but he's like, all right, I'm high, whatever. I'm not gonna think about this for another track. Just like, let's just chill out, man. But there's still like kind of those dark undertones to it a little bit, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of just like a bad trip you don't realize is a bad trip.
Yeah.
And then the,
oh fuck.
What?
Sorry. Keep go ahead. Go ahead.
And then the outro. Hell For It. Dylan, do you listen to James Ferraro? Or have you heard?
I have.
Does the beat remind you of some James Ferraro stuff? Because I remember listening to him. Like, I haven't even listened to that much James Ferraro, but I was like automatically thinking like, oh, this sounds like some shit that James Ferraro would do.
Kind of. Now that I mean, I didn't think about that when I first heard it, but now, yeah, no, you're kind of right.
It's definitely that sort of like minimalistic piano beat, and it's Danny Brown kind of saying like, hey, I'm essentially. Let me look at the lyrics real quick. From what I can tell from the gist of the song, it's essentially like, hey, I'm here to stay. Despite all the shit that I went through, like, I'm still here somehow, and you're going to deal with me for the next few years.
I think Paul White was the main producer on this, if I remember correctly, or at least for a majority of the album. Mm-hmm. Okay. And just shout out Paul White for not only doing this, but also doing...
Open Mike Eagle.
Two of my favorite, yeah, he put out two of my favorite hip-hop releases of the year, and in two very, very different styles as well. I mean, I'm amazed how he can go from just the sort of, like, whimsical introspectiveness of Open Mike Eagle to just the what the fuck is this kind of like cyberpunkish edge, like fucking like Blade Runner shit. This is almost basically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fantastic. And also, like, I wanted to mention real quick just the opening beat to Dance in the Water.
This very
tribal shit. I'm like, oh my god.
I don't think I've been blown away by, like, a sample on an intro since, like Punk Weight from Death Grips on Money Store. Like, that's the first time since then I was, like, since, like, the like a sample on the intro, I've been like, what the fuck? Like, how is he doing this? And again, whenever he said he spent $75,000 on samples, like, it's like, dude, money well spent. Like, every sample on here is fucking amazing and works well.
Yeah.
Like, Jesus Christ.
I mean, shit, just... Just shout out, quick shout out to also to Warp Records for getting Danny on the label and onto this fucking project. I mean, Warp has been known as just a great electronic label with Aphex Twin and Autechre and so many other Flying Lotus, Square Pusher, just so many. Artists that are ahead of their time, and to get Danny Brown is almost kind of like a dark horse in their catalog was like, okay, that's kind of weird, but you know, whatever. But he fit, I mean, this just fits completely in with just some of their most landmark releases, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's seriously
Danny Brown, they're kind of the two they doing their artists on Warp, but then you listen to their records and it makes sense. It makes perfect sense that they're there.
Yeah, basically. So really, just yeah, shout out to Warp. And also, you know, just other guys like One Trix Point Never, who I have to stan for eternity.
Forever.
Battles, the band Battles as well, who I loved to death. Just, you know, Warp just blows any other experimental label just out of the water, and I have to give just major credit to them, honestly, because I love just their entire label.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk very quickly about a short line that's one of my favorites. It's an opening line off this album, and it's, I'm like Kubrick with two bricks and hose on the strip.
We didn't even talk about that track. God, well, okay.
Here's the thing. In like 15 words, he makes two incredibly clever pieces of wordplay. The first being like comparing himself as like the Kubrick of drug dealing, even though Kubrick never did drugs.
That's fucking crazy.
And then he says, and hose on the strip off a two-piece, and two-piece is like two-piece chicken strips on the strip. Like, it's so genius.
Oh, God, man. Again, Lost, I think, also, when we were talking about Ain't It Funny, that's what makes Ain't It Funny, like, so great, was, like, you go from Lost, which is just, like, it's really, like, kind of, compared to the rest of them, a relatively kind of chill, like, basically, it's just Danny Brown, like, it's a braggadocio Danny Brown track, like, hey.
It's him, like, showing off his word playability, mm-hmm. essentially.
It's, you know, like, hey, I'm fucking, hey, look at me, like, I'm fucked up, but, like, I'm a fucking great rapper. And then, you know, that goes into, you know, that, just, like, that stack, like, shh, it's like, what? That's, again, but Lost is great, as we mentioned.
I could sell honey to a bee is honestly just my favorite line on this entire album.
I think my favorite line on the album, it also comes from Ain't It Funny, where, just the imagery of it, I think it's on the third verse, where, you know, staring in the devil's face, but you can't stop laughing. Staring in the devil's face, but you can't stop laughing. Like, that. I think that line really embodies the entirety of the album, of I'm laughing in the face of death. Like, that's just the level of fucked up I'm at right now.
As long as we're sharing, only way to your next to blow is if you're strapped with C4. Holy fucking shit.
Which one? What song? I forget. Which track is that off of?
That's from his first song, Really Dope.
Oh, really? Oh, yep. Shit.
God, there's so many lines. Might need rehab, but to me, that shit pussy. Like, ugh. And also, I think there's a couple of tracks we have mentioned. I want to say the track From the Ground was another really great, like, kind of emotional track, featuring Kalela. Is that how you pronounce her name? Who does a great hook?
Kalela,
and also I think did she produce this? Was this Paul White also production for this track, or
I think it was someone else on it. I forget who.
I'm gonna check real quick. Also, Pneumonia, Evie and Christ in the production on that. Pneumonia's a fucking god. Just the singles are also great, as we already mentioned with Really Dope. But When It Rained and Pneumonia are also just like fantastic singles that are, again, fit in the record really well. You know, just like just completely. This record it's my rap album of the year. It's absolutely insane. It's such.
Yeah, From the Ground was White producing. Okay.
Thank you. But like, God, it's such a forward thinking record, not just for hip hop, but just for music in general. It pushes the boundaries of what hip hop can be, which I think we need more artists who are doing that. Not artists who people think are doing that. Young Thug. I'm sorry. I have to
put a celebration. Right? Not taking shots.
I know.
I'm gonna launch it to a rant defending Jeffrey. All right, let's move on.
That's a matter of like subject matter pushing versus like flow, I guess, which are two different things.
Okay. Anyways, I don't want to diss because I almost got in trouble for this bug today on Twitter. Anyways, this again, it is very forward thinking. This is like. I will this record because, again, this is what the future of hip-hop sounds like. This is where the direction that it should be going in. I think, you know, artists like Danny and Kendrick and Earl and, who are some other... Or Death Grips I think a couple artists that you already know, Dylan. I think Milo and,
Milo. Shout out Billy Woods. Shout out, Jeremiah Ja.
Shout out another abrasive hip-hop artist, which is More Mother.
Oh, yeah, fuck yes, More Mother. I almost forgot about that.
You like it, not.
Oh god. But anyways, I love this record a lot. It's definitely Danny Brown at, you know, I think lyrically, it's definitely in terms of subject matter, it's his most kind of it's him kind of repeating some of the stuff he's already talked about before on previous records. It's not covering like super new ground. It's just kind of going back from his previous two records and really getting into the nitty gritty of where he didn't get quite into detail of how bad it can get, which I think he does so well in this record. And also,
I mean, it's not like the most, I don't think it's the most like experimental thing you've ever heard in your entire life, but it seriously doesn't sound like any other rap album I've ever heard.
No, it's completely its own thing.
Oh yeah.
Which is just insane. So yeah, I mean, do you guys have any final words? Because I think I've said all I need to say. Desire, Zach.
Yes.
Born to Run in stores now.
Jesus Christ. You're spoiling a future podcast, Josiah.
I just realized that Black Milk's birthday is precisely one day off from mine, so that's kind of cool.
I think it's a great way to close out this podcast. do you have any final words, Dylan?
I'm trying to think. Shout out to the rest of my top five. Shout out Aesop Rock. Shout out The Drones, Sojo Simpson, Bad Bad Not Good, Tim Hecker with the album Love Streams, who, you know, it's pretty much the only album that I think it's the only, I'm the only one in the chat that enjoys it.
No,
but
Stefan likes it. Wait, Love Streams?
Oh, yeah, no, me and Stefan are basically, yeah, Love Streams.
I like Love Streams. I like it.
I fell asleep to that album. But it was on purpose. Put it on specifically for the purpose of sleeping, and it worked quite well. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay. True nightmares. Okay. Anyways, we should probably wrap things up. Oh, actually, yeah. Zach and Josiah, Dylan, Jack, Zach, Josiah. They probably won't be on the next episode. So if you guys want to give your own little, your own top fives or any albums on your own list that didn't quite make our top 10, if you guys want to talk about.
Yo, shouts out to Bottomless Pit from the dude who enjoyed it more than the resident Death Grip stand.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Also, shouts out to Human Performance by Parquet Quartz, because I'm like the only one still standing that in this chat.
Bro, it's in my shouts top 10. Out. It's in my top 10. I loved it.
It didn't make the top 10, so I'm standing it. It's okay. Shouts out to Singing Saw by Kevin Morby. Shouts out to, of course, Wildflower. And shouts out to Shushu's Twin Peaks cover record.
Yes. Shout out Juju. I have that on CD. I need to listen to that, because that's a great fucking album.
All right, Zach, your shouts out.
Okay, very quick. Shouts out to Maxwell for releasing the best R&B project of the year. Shouts out to Hamilton Lighthouser and Rostam. And shouts out to Leonard Cohen, God rest his soul. Thank you for all the music. That's it. Let's go. All
right. So join us before the year ends for our final part of our Album of the Year list. We'll be going through our number 6 to number 1 pick. I won't reveal who's on the episode yet, but if you're wondering, why isn't this album on the list? Okay, we have six more albums to go through. Okay, it's probably gonna be there unless it's like Views, which we, no. But anyways, yeah, that's about it for our list for today. Or 7 to 10. To quick little recap before we let you guys go. Number 10, which was a tie between Nicholas Jar, Sirens, and Angel Olsen, My Woman. Number 9, James Blake, The Color in Anything. Number 8, Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds, Skeleton Tree. And number 7, Danny Brown, Atrocity Exhibition. So we'll see you guys before the year ends for our final episode of the year and the end of our podcast awards to end off our Album of the Year list. So we will see you guys later, and bye.
Happy New Year!
Pine Grove by Cardinal.